That's funny. If it was a joke. If not, you can save your speech for someone else, because I am not in the mood for politics right now.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 396 for the week of February 28th, 2022. I am lingering butt David T. Cole, and I'm here with Brady violation Sarah D. Bunting.
Discover this, counselor.
Indicted ham sandwich, Tara Ariana.
It'll never stick.
And two separate yet equally important groups, Mark Blankenship.
I contain multitudes.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Joining us for the first time in a very long time, back in the Blankenship chair, he's the reviews editor at Primetimer.com and the co-host of Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs. It's Mark Blankenship!
Yay!
Hello, Mark!
It's yay! Mark. We are, in fact, here to talk about season 21 of Law and Order, which just premiered last week. And here's what that show's about. In the criminal justice system, the people are represented by two separate yet equally important
groups. You
don't
have to do this for this one, I think.
Well,
I think we'll give you a pass on this one.
I just have, okay, so there's a little resetting info because some people are new. It's the Law and Order you cannot have possibly escaped knowledge of if you've been living on planet Earth at any point since 1990. Some of the same people from the previous season, which ended in 2010, are here, namely Anthony Anderson as Detective Kevin Bernard and Sam Waterston as DA Jack McCoy. The new people, Jeffrey Donovan as Detective Frank Cosgrove, you know him from Burn Notice, Cameron Manheim from The Practice as Lieutenant Kate Dixon, Odelia Halevi, new to me, she is ADA Samantha Maroon, and Hugh Dancy from Hannibal is E-ADA Nolan Price. The case in the season 21 premiere, what if Bill Cosby were a singer and his first rape accuser murdered him and his wife turned on him after his death? Also, is it ethical for a prosecutor to use a confession that cops elicited by lying to a suspect? And in our current climate, shouldn't people be much nicer to cops? Let's do the Chen check-in. Mark, should our listeners watch this new season of Law & Order?
No.
Sarah?
No.
Dave?
I don't know. It seems the same to me. You're gonna if you've watched it, have at it. If you don't like it, you know, nothing's going to change your mind here.
I mean, I feel like lifers are obviously going to watch it. I mean, but I feel it's different than when we were like set about Many Saints of Newark.
I think you're different. I don't think this show's that much different.
Okay. Disagree, but okay.
I'm not going to keep watching it, and I love the first run of the show. So let's start with Mark. Please take us through your emotional journey from when this season was announced to right now.
And if you could do it in a song, that would be great.
First, I have to take you back to a time known as the 90s. I have been watching Law & Order Mothership on the regs since it was on, I think it was on A&E.
Yep.
Sure was.
So we're going on 25, 26 years of my life that I've been watching the show regularly. And I, during the pandemic, rewatched seasons 2 through 10 in their entirety. And I can tell you that those seasons are still incredibly satisfying to me. I love them. Even the episodes that aren't spectacular are still pretty great. And there are so many things about the show that, to me, were never replicated by any of the franchise spinoffs.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that the original Law & Order was going to come back created this sense of hope in me that the things I loved the most would return to the franchise, mm-hmm. and that I would be slipping into an old cardigan with a Werther's original maybe in the pocket, and it would just be, and I would be able to say, Thomas Wolfe was wrong, you can go home again. So that was what I was fully expecting, and it didn't happen that way, but that's what I was hoping for.
Yeah. I have to agree. Sarah, as our resident expert, please give us a compare contrast between how SVU engages or tries to or pretends to try to with the discourse on policing and pop culture and this show, at least based on the pilot, or I mean the premiere.
Well, this is the thing. I think that for those of us absolute franchise lifers who are still sticking with SVU, a lot of the things that were sucky about the reboot are actually familiar mm-hmm. about SVU. But the thing is, they need to stay on SVU. And that, like, I don't know, Detective Goofus harasses our citizens of color.
Yeah.
Detective Gallant understands that you have to take people as they cut, blah, 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 blah.
Uh-huh.
We are very used to that as SVU watchers. But as ham-handed as Mothership could be about questions of police ethics, copaganda, racism in policing, the conversations that are being had on this iteration are, it's material that was covered in like grievisodes mm-hmm. in season one. It's not done any more elegantly here. Nothing against Anthony Anderson generally, but Bernard was absolutely my least favorite detective, maybe tied with Milena Govich. Like, I just am not about it, and I wish he hadn't come back. But SVU is like, SVU is very preachy and is trying to have it both ways by being a cop show, but being like, look, we're woke, TM.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to see that in Mothership, which was much less apologetic about what it was and
yeah.
should just have the courage of its convictions, as it were,
yeah,
and be what it is.
Yeah.
But they changed, I mean, they even changed the theme song to this fucking ugh. Fugazi ringtone version of itself. And the individual who has appeared in more episodes of Law & Order across the franchises than anyone, Nicky Scarfo Jr., no longer in the credits. What are you doing? Like, the diehards don't want this. They
yeah.
don't want yeah. this SVU-ized version of Mothership. You should have left it in the grave. This is what happens when you monkey's paw something like this.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this is that's the ultimate problem, is that it's not going to satisfy people who want a show that tries to present policing in its all its ugliness, and it's not going to satisfy people
right.
who just want to watch the old show that did not
yeah.
address those. And the reason I feel like is that they decided it was crucial for this show to have Jack McCoy back. And we know from the original series, Jack McCoy is like, anything goes. If I can get away with shit, even if it's
yeah.
grossly unethical, I'm going to do it. And he basically says that in this episode, too. And so yep. that's why we have these fake arguments between him and this new guy, Nolan, played by Hugh Dancy, where he's like, I'm not going to admit this confession that was elicited because Frank Cosgrove lied to the suspect. And then McCoy later being like, too bad for you. It's fine to be, you know, ethically pure if you know you have the win and you didn't. So sucks. But I mean, they do.
Yeah. And then he turns around and is like, let me cynically leverage an absolute trauma in your family.
Yes.
DA,
ooh,
yes.
That was gross.
In order to win this. And then he just looks all fucking Will from Hannibal about it. I hate this casting. I hate it.
Well, the thing that made me so crazy watching this is, again, having just rewatched 9 effing seasons of the original show,
yeah.
I feel confident that I'm speaking correctly here. The original show, by and large, was able to introduce these cultural ideas in the service of solving the case.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would get conversations about, is the internet destroying society? But it
yeah.
would be because the internet killed someone, inevitably.
Right.
And I'm not saying it wasn't obvious what they were doing, but there was a certain elegance to the way that they were able to weave in social and cultural arguments into the process of solving the murder. And in this piece of crud episode, I'm so upset about it that I'm actually reverting into a sort of Goody Blankenship language, apparently. I can't curse. But they didn't even try to integrate the social arguments into the rest of the episode. It's like
right.
you could hear the emergency brake being pulled on and the car screeching as they stop everything to say, like, well, I don't know. I think those cameras are actually they're keeping us on our toes. It's like,
yeah.
they don't even try to make it part of the story. They just, and it's so inelegant. And then also equally inelegant, as Sarah just referenced, is the thunderingly obvious exposition for these new characters that gets shoved in.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the writing is so lazy that when it's giving us exposition it's that completely obvious. But then it doesn't even name Cameron Manheim's character.
Right.
So yeah. We don't even know her name. If it weren't for IMDb, we would not know this woman's name.
Yeah.
So either it's, I'm going to stop everything, and the way that I'm going to give this ADA a character is be like, remember when your sister got killed?
Yeah.
Or Cameron Manheim doesn't even get a name. It's so lazy. The writing is so bad.
Yeah. Her name is Lucille Tennant. They call her Lou. And then they have a whole, like, Socratic colloquy about racism in policing, during which the phrase some gangbanger is used. Like, when is it in the writer's room? This episode was written by Dick Wolf and Rick Ide, who was the showrunner for several of the franchises at various points. And I think went over to the Chicagoland part of the Wolfverse.
Mm-hmm.
These people never die. They're just shuffled off to Chicago Med. Just kidding. They walk 15 feet from the civilians that Burn Notice was just harassing. And also, like, just let him fucking be from Boston, okay?
Seriously.
Like, he can't control his accent. Don't bother. Mm-hmm. People move around among departments. Stanley Tucci was from Scotland Yard on Fortitude. Like, just let it happen.
Right. It's also weird that they cast Jeffrey Donovan when he looks so much to me like Robert John Burke, who has had that role on SVU as an IA guy who dated Liv for a while when I was still watching that show.
Oh, yeah. He's dead now, Tucker.
Oh, RIP.
Peter, yeah.
So which new character is the most annoying, then, in your opinion, Mark?
I think it's the Hugh Dancy character. The other characters are blank enough that I don't really have an opinion about them, except for Burn Notice, who's like, he's the sort of gruff up from the streets cop. And it's like, okay, but at least
we're calling
something...
him Burn Notice because it's like, you know, insert vaguely Irish last name here. Like, oh, guys, but, try, please.
It's like when they looked at the whiteboard of schematic design for Law and Order, they thought, well, the executive assistant district attorney has to be a firebrand, but we've already got Jack McCoy. So we have to make him a firebrand in another way. And the mathematics of his character are just too obvious and it makes me crazy.
Yeah. Sarah.
Yeah. It's Hugh Dancy. I wound up having a Slack conversation with my Quaid and Full co-host Jeb Lund about the fact that both of us wished that Hannibal had eaten that guy in like episode two. Spoiler, he didn't. But there's just something about, like, I don't think Dancy is bad. He just tends to be in projects that I like in spite of him. And I don't think he's the right guy for this. And what's worse, I think he can sense that. And he keeps kind of cutting his eyes to camera like, well, this won't last probably, right? Like, well, not with that attitude.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, he's Bogue, not a fan. It's not really his fault. It doesn't work.
Yeah, with all due non-respect to Burn Notice, a.k.a. the world's youngest Frank, I have to agree. It's Hugh Dancy as this Nolan guy. And part of the reason is twofold. One, his American accent has not gotten better and he's gotten lots of practice.
Yeah.
But two, he also had an arc on The Good Fight. And that just reminds us of like, oh, that's the show that's doing all the stuff that Mark was talking about, where it's like presenting ideas from culture, doing that in a way that's like so much more satisfying because they're defense attorneys. Like, it's they have so much more leeway to do stuff and be on, you know, not always the right side, but more often, I think, than probably prosecutors. Dave, do you care to weigh in?
It's Jeffrey Donovan because he's got resting beaker face and I can't get beyond it.
He really does. Or like resting Kennedy face. Like, it's a drunk history episode involving the Kennedys. Get Donovan on the line. Like, look at his IMDb. He has played John or Jack or Jeff or like Rosemary, like 100 times.
Or Maria Shriver.
Seriously. We need to talk, though, about Jamie Ross.
Oh, yes, we do.
I am enraged. Like, Carrie Lowell took a while to grow on me, but she might secretly be like coming up on a tie with Angie Harmon, especially because I love the LA trilogy and I think she's a complete badass in that.
Mm-hmm.
set of episodes, they bring her in here so that she can get thrown under the bus, and then she has no scenes with anyone who really remembers her. Yeah. Why did they burn her like this? I don't get it.
Yeah.
It's bizarre that given her long working relationship with Jack, that they don't show them interacting at all. Except for him, like, watching her leave court and, like, glaring at her judgmentally, where it's like, well, is she fired? Like, you are her boss.
Yeah, which, like, you don't get to do that. You've been sanctioned, like, 68 times. You shouldn't even be alive.
Also, if it hadn't been for Jamie Ross going to the ethics committee and sort of pushing to keep Jack to get to keep his license, he wouldn't be sitting in the DA's chair right now,
yeah.
Jack. Also, they completely retconned what happened to Jamie, because Jamie left the DA's office to become a prosecutor. And it's okay, sure, fine, she can come back, but they should at least acknowledge that she was a defense attorney for a while.
Oh, yes, she left.
I just misspoke.
You did, yes.
In the original series, she leaves the defense, she leaves the district attorney, becomes a defense attorney.
Yeah.
Again, because she had been one before, I believe.
Right. So they just never acknowledge that she keeps ping-ponging across the aisle or whatever, and
well, let's briefly talk about the case of the week. Were the tweaks from the headlines that it was based on enough to interest you, or did it just feel like this was an SVU episode manqué?
There was so little about it that was interesting in the way it was explored that I didn't give a damn.
Mm-hmm. The only thing that I remember about it is Lisa Arendelle playing the wife, Veronica King, because she was doing a lot in that performance. Oh my God.
She was
so overacting.
I mean, and sometimes the way that they tweak the cases so that they don't get sued basically by actual people on SVU is to make it utter, like, almost Tarantino level wish fulfillment and just like burn these people literally to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, like, that fantastic series on Showtime, We Need to Talk About Cosby, like, that just, like, the way that this is timed is even more unfortunate for Law and Order, which just seems like this extremely, like, young, but also okay boomer way of confronting these issues. And once again, like, we already have SVU to do this, and particularly with this case, like,
yeah.
Think of something else. I mean, but the other thing is, like, there's a reason, I assume, that Mark, your rewatch stopped after a certain point, which is that every single case wound up being somehow tied to the war overseas and, like, post 9/11 terrorism concerns in the city. It wasn't that good when it ended.
Yeah.
Right.
I personally was content with what we had and to sort of tag out after a certain number of seasons, but it's like, I don't know. I just think they were like, oh, we can reboot this IP, or we can restart this IP, and it'll be like, no time has passed. Like, that's not a good thing. You have to actually have something to say.
Yeah, it's true that the show was running on fumes for like 8 years, because my rewatch is going to stop at season 11, the last Angie Harmon season, because, like Sarah, she is my MVP, ADA. Because, yeah, after that, it actually did. I guess that's another thing that I could use to frame my disappointment. I hoped that the show would lose some of the traits it developed at the end of its initial run and go back to what it was, but instead it tripled down on those really unfortunate, hacky tendencies.
Yeah.
It's time to go around the dial. First up, Tara.
Hi. I am going to talk first about Super Pumped. Mike Isaac is a reporter at the New York Times who covers technology. And in 2019, he wrote a book about Uber, the ride-sharing service, called Super Pumped, which was so well received that I bought it, although classic me, I have not read it yet. But maybe now I will, because I'm sure not going to watch more of the TV series that Showtime made out of it. P.U. I definitely understand there are elements that all stories about tech disruptors have in common, so it's probably to be expected that the pilot, which is all that's aired so far and all I've watched, feels like a Social Network retread. There's a self-regarding weirdo who has somehow convinced a bunch of people who should really know better to give him their time and or money. There are legal and financial setbacks because what they're all trying to make is so new, people don't know how to deal with it. Whoops, the thing they're trying to make is actually probably bad for humanity. And in this case, Travis Kalanick, the founder of what is initially called Uber Cab, is more outwardly charming than Mark Zuckerberg, but he's played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I'm going to say about him what I said about Ryan Reynolds after watching either Free Guy or Red Notice. Doesn't matter. Same problem. Is he just this guy all the time? Yes, Dave.
Point of order. Is this series originally called Mr. Carman?
I don't know. I think not.
I just got there. Hello. Good one, Dave.
In Reynolds' case, that guy means glib, quippy, skimming the surface of life. In Joseph Gordon-Levitt's, it's flipping between manipulative grins and ragey monologues. And even in Mr. Corman, not Mr. Carman, it was ragey monologues, but the rage was turned inward since that was about his character having depression. Anyway, this show would be a heavy lift for me to stick with because the scenes of Silicon Valley's guys bullshitting each other about completely banal ideas that they are treating like world-changing innovations make me want to die. Like, there's surely going to be a lot of this in The Dropout, too, which we'll be talking about next week. But at least there, it's also about blood. So it's, you know, metal. But what ultimately drove me away is how much the writing apes Aaron Sorkin. And again, I get it. If you're Brian Koppelman, 50-something creator of Billions, writing a story about tech, you're going to look to an Oscar-winning screenplay by another, at the time, 50-something man as a model. But 50-something is too old to be writing about tech. Sorry. Also, The Social Network is bad, and so is this. Let's hear a representative clip.
Benchmark comes in on Uber Cab. We are...
Minted, yeah. You said. Yep, you get upped. Right. Mm-hmm. Open the books.
Made. This has got to work. I don't know, though. He's just going to see a guy in these lame jeans and these fucking shoes. I don't know what these shoes are.
Nah, he'll see you're a dun-colored mare.
What?
From Raise High the Roof Beam? Salinger, don't worry, you'll read it later. What it means is your ideas will matter, not your clothes. He'll see that.
What are you doing tonight?
Reading up on this new cancer drug before I get ready to take it public.
I'm just gonna throw this guy so much attitude he won't even pay attention to the clothes.
Don't be the Winston Wolf cool version of Travis. Be open. Show him that you're vulnerable and need his money and his protection.
Yeah, no.
One final thing before I move on to my other show. Your city's cab drivers almost certainly have an app where you can order a car for an hour later. Those drivers are usually in co-ops, which are much more equitable. Delete Uber, support cab drivers directly. Instead, when I'm in New York, I use Curb and it is fine. Love is Blind. I teased this last week. Ooh. So I talked about Love is Blind back in 2020. I watched half of the first season and then stopped. But this is the Netflix dating show where a bunch of guys and a bunch of ladies get to know each other in pods separated by an opaque wall. And the idea is to fall in love or try to on a soul level, which without such superficial considerations as looks. Yes, Dave.
Can I just explain in my mind what happens next based on your description, having never seen the show?
Yeah.
Of two people on either side of an opaque wall.
Uh-huh.
And then it just becomes the scenes from the movie Arrival, where the weird alien language appears on the screens.
Oh, God, I wish.
I was going to say someone comes and cuts a glory hole and whatever happens, happens. But I'm
either
a disgusting person.
Much more compelling show. So, but the idea is to not think about looks. Although this season we do see one guy trying to ask the ladies questions like, I love going to music festivals. If we went, could I put you up on my shoulders in a way he thinks is sly? But they're like, you're trying to figure out if I'm fat. Like, you're not that smart. Anyway, after an undetermined period of time, someone of one sex may choose to propose marriage to someone of the opposite sex. And if their intended accepts, they see each other in person for the first time the next day. Although, as our friend Adam Grossworth has noted, because this all seems to be happening in a windowless warehouse, it's impossible to tell how much time has passed in the pods. But from here, it's a lot of the same stuff that happens on Love is Blind's sister show, Married at First Sight, just in a different order. The engaged couples all get whisked off to the same resort in Mexico for what is basically a honeymoon. And then they go back to the town where they live, I think, unclear. In this case, they're all in Chicago. They move into furnished apartments, introduce each other to whatever friends and family are local, and plan their weddings, which happen 2 weeks after they move into those apartments.
I thought you were going to say whatever friends and family were
they
left.
They have. That's basically the case with some of them. Anyway,
yeah.
It's not until they're actually at the vows that they say whether they do or not. And this is rude to say. It's also why you're here. The reason this season worked so much better for me than season one is that this crop of daters are so dumb. So dumb. Obviously, you have to fall under a pretty low bar to apply to be on the show at all. But I feel like these ones are even dumber than the ones in the first season. In the first episode alone of season two, we hear people say things like, nothing could be further from the opposite. And on a scale of 1 to 10, I'm a catch. Of course, a process like this is going to work for people who, again, as on Married at First Sight, will have an easy time finding common ground with strangers they never see because all of their interests and opinions are unimpeachably conventional. The closest we get to a real clash of values is when Shayna is approaching a match with Will, but then finds out he's an atheist, whereas she is a Christian. And how will they raise the kids they are totally, definitely going to have? And then we meet her family. It becomes clearer that Christian is probably standing in for extreme reactionary, which the show can't say because it's trying its hardest to be apolitical and out of time. Without spoiling the ending, there's also a situation this season where one woman is very into a particular guy, but then a different woman is much more assertive with him and gets him to agree to call her his girlfriend, which, like, in this context means even less than when you were in kindergarten and said you had a girlfriend or boyfriend. The first woman never really lets go, including later when they're all out of the pods. But then that love triangle kind of goes nowhere. Like, given the structure of the show, I guess it makes sense that couples have no time to do anything except plan their wedding and fight with each other. But I feel like it's worth lengthening the timeline and putting on more group, like, hangouts so people who are pining and people who might be regretting their choices could interact with each other more. Ultimately, the show runs on extremely damaged people who have decided to do this instead of get therapy, like people who imprint on each other, literally sight unseen because they are so terrified of being alone, and say things like, he's my best friend, about people with whom they have spent maybe a week sharing oxygen. And I commend the good people at Kinetic Entertainment for finding these absolute morons and for continuing to push the boundaries of how bonkers a dating show can actually be. It's 10 episodes, and if any of this sounds like it might interest you, it probably will. For my plugs, I have two. Catherine, our friend Catherine Van Arendonk, talked to the creator of the show, Chris Colan, about the season two finale. It has a lot of spoilers, so, you know, be wary. But lots of insider information there. And I also want to plug the, again, with this Patreon, because listeners of this podcast may be interested to hear Sarah and I this Friday talking about Nick Fury, : Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., a 1998 TV movie pre-MCU starring David Hasselhoff as Nick Fury. It's really something. That is patreon.com/againwiththis. Both of those will, we will link in the show notes.
Mr. Mark Blankenship in the Blankenship chair, what do you have?
Well, I have two things I must say in response to Tara's excellent work. One, remember when people were vehemently insisting that gay marriage ruined the sanctity of marriage?
Yes.
Hmm? Where
you say that
are
in the past
now?
Tense as though they have stopped, well, right. But yes.
But I hear you describe this show and I'm like, where are the outraged people on the 700 Club to talk about this?
Or 90 Day Fiancé or Married at First Sight
or
Married by
Temptation
America
Islands.
Was one from like 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And
God.
The other thing, I would just really kick myself if I didn't bring this up. The clip that you played from the Uber Eats show or whatever, it was so clear in what we heard from that female character, and I, again, have not seen this, but because she references Salinger in an offhand way, it was so clear that in the script, the description of her character was, she's beautiful, but she's too smart to focus on it, or
right,
something like that.
Right, right. There's also the aspect that we could hear in that clip where, like, we hear that she's doing research about a cancer drug where it's like, oh, she's also accomplished and special, but just not as special as the guy.
Right. Like, she's really, really sexy, but she also reads Salinger and, like, makes things. So, oh my God, you guys.
Her talent is being supportive.
Well, we're pitching things based on Tara's segment.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but this came into my head. What if there's a dating show that is people and it's sort of like half blind or whatever, but it's people and they have to date people who are role-playing as cryptics? Be like Ogopogo and Nessie and Bigfoot, and maybe they fall in love, maybe they don't. I don't know. There's something there. We can make it happen.
I thought you were going to say, a dating show that happens in a cab where it's like blind dating in the back of a cab where you combine Uber and.
So instead of cash like, cab, it's ass cab?
Yes. Ass cab?
I'd watch that, especially if it's the same host. That guy's a fox.
My husband won cash cab many years ago, 2006.
Oh, I always forget about that. It all comes back around.
Okay, so for the show that I've been watching recently, it's a show that I love that I never thought I would love, and that is Reacher on Amazon Prime, mm-hmm. a show that if you had described it to me before I started watching it, I would have said, well, I'm not a 65-year-old grandfather.
The most shocking moment of my week was seeing you put this in our doc, because I would have never in 1 billion years guessed that this would cross your consciousness.
I know. So the thing, the reason I watch it is because it was something I did for primetimer.com plug. But I watched the first two episodes and I was like, oh shit, I really want to know how this ends. And so for those of you who do not know, Jack Reacher is a character created by Lee Child, the type of author whose work is advertised on the subway.
And it's airport, it's airplane books. My husband owns all of them.
But yeah, you know,
to build
same
a
difference.
Shed in the yard.
Same difference, like airport books, subway advertisements. It's like literature that is not intended to win a Pulitzer Prize. Let's just put it that way.
Sure.
But Jack Reacher is in the books, as I understand it, and especially in this show, the unassailable mythologized form of heterosexual masculine power as seen in 80s action films. He comes from a world where right and wrong are completely apparent. It's very obvious who is good and who is bad. And the idea behind Reacher, the series, is that if Reacher thinks that you're good, you will eventually get to kick the ass of someone who is bad. And you spend 8 episodes watching a small Georgia town be beset by a group of international counterfeiters who are killing people in horrendous ways so that they can go about making fake money. Now, all of these things are symbolically obvious, right? Like making fake money is a way of saying that these people are destroying American capitalism, which in a world like this is unacceptable. Reacher himself is like a 6.5-foot beast of a man. And there are constant jokes about how did you get so big? Like, I swear to God, every 15 seconds, this show will take a break from what it's doing to have someone make a joke about how no t-shirts could possibly fit this hulk of a man. Or there's one scene where he's walking through a park and a little kid just goes, how did you get so big? And he says, genetics, and then walks on. But it is the presence of this type of self-aware winking that to me makes this show quite enjoyable, because I am just a person and I like adrenaline-fueled plot-based stories as much as the next dude. And the fact that this show gives me lots of ass-kicking but gives me a little bit of winking self-awareness lets me feel more invested in its tropes, because the show is aware of its tropes. It's not trying to pretend like they aren't there. It knows that they're there. They go through all of these plot contrivances in the very last episode, I won't spoil it too much, to make sure that our three central characters get to kick the ass of the three villains who most perfectly parallel them. So, like, there's one guy who essentially has to come back from the dead so that the, quote, right person can kill him for the story to wrap up. And you know what?
Wow.
I'm here for it. I loved it. I told my dad to watch it because my dad is in his 70s and he liked it.
Yeah.
Yay. I honestly cannot believe how much I enjoyed it. But the fact is, I cannot wait for the next season. Reacher, I can be a red meat eating straight guy too.
Mark, you've been talking about Reacher for about 4 minutes now. So at this point, we have to interject and say, why do they have so much cow feed? That's the other thing that happens twice.
Do you want
episode.
Me to really tell you? Because I do know.
No, we talked about it last week. We also.
Okay. Well, listeners, anyway, Reacher. Surprisingly for me.
All right. What do you want to plug? Readers can, or listeners can find you at twitter.com/IamBlankenship. What else?
You can also find me starting March 7th at primetimer.com, where I will be, as previously mentioned, the reviews editor. And of course, you can hear me with Sarah D. Bunting of Extra Hot Great on Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs, a long-running pop music podcast that will soon enough be coming back in an exciting new format.
Few true crime things that you may not have been aware of. The first one is on IMDb TV, which I still can't explain to you the exact nature of this streaming service. Just Google
the name of the show you want to watch. It will probably send you to Amazon. I don't get it. Mm-hmm. Here's the deal. They have a show coming out, a four-part series called Bug Out, which begins Thursday the 4th. And it's about a heist, or was it, from the Philadelphia Insectarium and Butterfly Pavilion. And from there, you get into like bug smuggling, tarantulas as federal evidence.
Whoa.
Like larval fraud. It's a whole lot of characters. And I watched all four episodes. Like, it's sort of over-directed in that way that a lot of these things are. It should have just been a 110-minute feature instead of four installments, but that's how they can put ads on it, because IMDb TV is, that's its jam, is like Peacock for free. This is, I believe, an IMDb TV original from a first-time director named Ben Feldman. No relation, I'm assuming. It's actually pretty entertaining. Like, the fact that the episodes are short, the visuals are compelling. If you skeeve a particular kind of insect, this may not be for you. Like, maybe you just want to listen to it, unless you also skeeve Philadelphia accents. I feel like I spent a lot of time with those this week. You'll hear why in a few minutes. But it's, I liked it because it kept things moving. It was a story I didn't know. And it stayed within itself. It wasn't trying to be like, this has to be eight episodes that are 65 minutes each. It was like, this is kind of a small story. It has a couple of things to tell us about, like, wildlife fraud. And at one point, a tarantula emerges from someone's mouth, and it's not okay. So when there's a dude named Kelvin on your screen, just look away, because that's not going to be for everyone, but I did enjoy it. And that starts, as you're listening to this, tomorrow, wherever you get IMDb TV in a question mark, like, just merge with Amazon, whatever. The other one that I recommend, which I did not think I would, is Netflix's Worst Roommate Ever. This winds up devolving into true crime. That dropped, as you're listening to this, a couple days ago. I mean, it's probably stories that you've heard before, and there is a familiar structural rhythm to it. Like, it is sort of Dateline-y in the way it's like, it starts with a 911 call, and then there's contemporary news reports. But this one is much better at centering victims, whether they're there to speak for themselves in the story or not. But without being performatively, this is the cost of violent crime about it. It just does it, which is a little bit unusual. And this one also is quite self-contained. Most of the episodes are around 45 or 50 minutes. There are only five of them. It's actually four stories. One of them is a two-parter. I've only seen one of them. But I mean, I enjoyed it. And I also enjoyed the fact that with so much prestige true crime coming at us this month, it's just like a strong B that you can listen to while you're paying bills.
Yep.
And it manages to do what it needs to do without being cynical and by numbers shortcutty about it. So again, the title's a little flip, but these are some pretty bad roommates. And I mean, yeah, it's not great, but the show actually is quite good. It's also not great, but it's quite good. Worst Roommate Ever. That's on Netflix. And I reviewed both of these things at bestevidence.fyi. But my actual plug is for Mark, who recently appeared on the Quaid in Full podcast, season 6, episode 5 on Far From Heaven. We had a lovely conversation about the hypocrisy of Dennis Quaid's character when it came to, and I quote Mark, all the cock he's been sucking. So yes, the usual classy convocation between me and Mr. Blankenship, aka the Duchess of D. So we're Quaid in Full Pod on Twitter, and there will be a link to the Far From Heaven episode in the show notes, and I hope you check it out.
All right, coming up on the extra hot great podcast, it is Hall Marketing. Lovuary may be over, and we're all sad that it is. But we extend the Hallmark marketing message throughout the year. Check that out. All supporters, patreon.com/extrahotgreat to join them. And then right here on the next EHG Prime, it is The Dropout with, now that this is what she's known as now because of this typo, Eve Bat. Now, Eve Beatty joins us for a discussion of The Dropout.
That's all my press.
Today's extra credit topic comes to us from Alon M. It is called Resticking the Landing, and Alon writes, you know how a lot of recent miniseries, cough, Marvel cough, have us on the edge of our seat, not because we want to know what happens, but because we want to know if it will be yet another total nothing burger? Pick a series that should have had an ending where the ending was no ending, and give it a good ending. Wish Fulfillment or Westfall Snow Globe's okay, too. I'm going to go first. Glow! In case you couldn't hear that, that was me saying glow mournfully. I will mourn it until my dying day. We were just about to see what would happen when Debbie ascended to her ultimate form as a TV executive when Netflix renewed and then unrenewed it. So in the season 4 of My Heart, we get to see what other late 80s TV programming Debbie and Bash start commissioning. And given the era, it's probably going to be syndicated action schlock in the Hercules mold and cheapo game shows, which would give us new worlds to explore. We'd meet all the on-camera and behind-the-scenes talent who have their own neuroses and craziness. I want to see Bash and Debbie's win-loser-draw knockoff with Sam Richardson as the host. I just do. Meanwhile, although Ruth has committed to continue as a wrestler in the next iteration of GLOW, she can't help wondering if she made the right choice in declining to transition into directing. Back in L.A., she tries to bring the lessons she's learned from her years as a wrestler to other kinds of auditions. And though she treasures her time with the other gorgeous ladies, we close out the series with both Debbie and Ruth on top, the former acquiring another network and continuing up the ladder to her Ted Turner destiny, and Ruth getting cast as the lead in an alien-esque, gritty sci-fi action film with tons of franchise potential. Oh, what might have been. Goddamn you, Netflix forever. Mark.
Okay, I would watch that. And I also want to know what happens with Bash's sexuality.
Yes,
same.
Does Bash get a boyfriend?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I tried not to be the most basic, obvious version of myself, but I must be, because the only answer for me here is My So-Called Life.
Oh, fuck. Same.
Oh, no.
Let's go.
I didn't pick it because I knew Sarah would.
Fight. I shouldn't have.
I tried to be a different person, but I knew I had to be myself.
Well, let's see. Stack them.
Okay, well, if you'd like me to, Sarah, I can just improvise something new.
No, please. I knew this was a risk.
So My So-Called Life, beloved to at least three of us on this call, ended very abruptly at the end of episode 19 with Brian revealing to Angela that he was the one who had basically been Cyrano to Jared Leto's character and then Jordan Catalano. And so then Angela is confronted with the fact that Brian likes her, and he says, just forget it, just forget it, just forget it. And she's like, how can I? And then she drives off, and it's just like, oh my God. So, oh, also, Ricky Vasquez has just been taken in by his gay drama teacher after being kicked out of his house. And Rayanne is continuing to just be Rayanne and try to have emotional breakthroughs that she's never going to get. And we're wondering if Graham is going to wreck his own home with that no good strumpet Hallie Lowenthal. And Bess Armstrong as Patty Chase is continuing to be the bomb. So I want to see seasons 2 through 5 of this show, because 3 and 4 are 11th and 12th grades. No, 2, 3, and 4. It's 11th, 12th grades. And then the first two years that they're in college. That's what I feel like is going to work out. And what we're going to learn is the following. Angela and Brian are going to actually try dating for a while, because Angela is going to use it as a way to get back at Jordan, and she's not going to have the wherewithal to see how it's going to hurt Brian. Then she is going to actually kind of fall for Brian, but he's going to discover that she was only using him to get back at Jordan, and so that's going to ruin the possibility, and Angela is going to find herself bereft just in time to go to college, where she will meet someone who is kind of like the combination of Brian and Jordan in that he leans great but also knows how to read. And then we will see her discovering what it's like to be in a relationship with someone who is actually an adult. I should also mention that, of course, we are going to learn that Sharon Chersky, played by Devin Odessa, is a lesbian. That's not going to be neither here. It'll be neither here nor there. But obviously, she's a lesbian. So that's what we're going to discover when she continues on her journey. Patty and Graham are actually going to get divorced. Graham is going to think that he's going to live with Hallie Lowenthal forever, but of course that's not going to last. But it's going to give Patty an opportunity to discover parts of herself that she had never before seen, and it's going to show young Danielle, who is growing up to be a proto-feminist, that this is how, Danielle, of course, being Angela's sister, that this is how one's life can go on in the face of apparent tragedy. We will, of course, see the family learn to cope with this new structure. Angela will forgive her father. All will be well. And unfortunately, Jared Leto will decide that he doesn't want to be on this show anymore because his movie career is beckoning him. So Jordan Catalano will die in an unfortunate accident that involves a meat locker.
Mm, great. Oh,
and I'm sorry, I forgot. Ricky Vasquez will actually go on to become a pioneering member of a fashion collective that develops, and he doesn't go to college because he doesn't need to. And Rayanne Graff will inevitably end up dating a series of dudes, end up running a record store, and then end up managing a restaurant, and she'll find a way to be happy with all of it.
Or Sarah.
Okay, historically, I think that my so-called life non-ending ending is considered a pretty good splitting of the difference, given that the show knew it was a pretty good shot to get sacked and would have to get a lot of work done in both directions at a finale that turned out to be the series finale. But since we know now that it did not come back, and we also know a lot about what Winnie Holtzman et al. Were planning to do in terms of moving plots forward that never came to fruition, now that we know that this is a series finale, I would kind of like a scene added after the "and dance by the light of the moon" card at the end. After Angela and Jordan have pulled away in red, after everything, you pan across the skyline of Three Rivers and over into an apartment building where a cat is entering an open window from a fire escape. Zoom up on the cat's collar, which has a tag reading "Chase 412-555-0134 or whatever. And then follow the cat over to a living room table where a guy is staring into the flame of a white pillar candle. Visible taped onto a wall nearby is a frozen embryos poster. Off screen, someone moving around in the kitchen asks, "Tea?" And the guy says no. Snaps his fingers and the candle goes out. So we've seen the chase's cat. We've seen Tino. We have proof of the Grand Watchman theory of the universe. Tino has been controlling everything. What would he have done next? We'll never know. It's not for mortals to know.
Hi, Extra Hot Great. I am presenting episode 1 of Mayor of Easttown, Miss Lady Hawk herself. First of all, cards on the table. I chose this as my canon submission as a way to force in the esteemed panel to watch this wonderful show. Not being a frequenter of social media myself, I somehow missed this show when it was on and did not discover it until I heard about it on the BBC Film Review radio show. I typically rely on EHG for what to watch. P.S. Thank you for Girls Forever and The Flight Attendant, by the way. So I'm a little hurt for not hearing about this from my favorite TV pod. But I digress. Here are my reasons for why this episode is canon-worthy. 1. Mayor. Kate Winslet's mayor is not your tropey, strong female character. She's a strong character who happens to be female, and with the complexities that are usually only written into their male counterparts. Mayor is also a realistic portrayal of someone who is clearly good at their job, while doing their best to juggle their personal life. She feels guilt for not making any progress in a year-long missing persons case, while raising a 4-year-old grandson, a back-talking daughter who seems to prefer her ex-husband, played by a near-unrecognizable Roy from The Office, who happens to live in the house right behind hers. And she deals with all this in a very straightforward, matter-of-fact way. 2. Easttown. This episode does a good job of setting up the overarching mysteries, and at the same time assures us that this is not going to be an unsatisfying mystery box type of show. I'm still salty about Lost, can you tell? In the same way that Knives Out's mansion and dysfunctional family clearly defines the sandbox in which we are going to explore, Easttown and its residents serve the same purpose. The insular nature of the small town suggests that there is going to be a small subset of suspects. The tight-knit setting also means our heroine gets to take some shortcuts not available to, say, a New York City detective. She doesn't have to chase Freddy the whole way because she knows he's just running back home. She probably won't have to wait for the family to give a positive ID for the dead girl at the end of the episode, as Mayor probably not only knows the victim's name, but can also tell you who her cousins are. And we as the viewers are excited to spend time in this little town, collecting the clues alongside Mayor, knowing that it's a small sandbox that we get to explore. 3, the accent. Okay, so this gets unfairly weighted more by me and perhaps other Pennsylvanians, but Woodlands Delaware County accent is impeccable. If it were up to me alone, I would enshrine this in the canon as a moment in TV history just for a Brit pulling off this very specific Philly accent in such a convincing way. I grew up in the middle of Pennsylvania, went to grad school in Philly, and now reside in Pittsburgh, so I have experienced all 3 distinct PA accents, and I have to give Winslet an A+ for her work here. For comparison, Bilbo gets a D- for his efforts in Fargo, and I don't know what Guy Pearce is doing with his accent. In conclusion, to Sarah D. Bunting, the true criminess of this should hopefully appeal to you, and I think the proximity to Jersey is like a dollop of cheese whiz on this well-made piece of buttonet. To Tara, I hope you agree with my points above, plus the episode throws in pieces of both Catfish and Teen Mom for good measure. To Dave, I still can't predict what you will and you won't hate after 350-plus episodes, so I don't know what you're going to vote. And finally, valued guest, I'm hoping you chose this submission out of the hopper because you at least agree with one of my points. Thank you for your consideration.
This is a fan. Thank you, Carlos. Mark,
this presentation was absolutely canon worthy. Well done.
That was great.
Yes. So, Mark, you did choose this out of the hopper as predicted. Please start us off.
Okay. I chose this because I think that Mayor of Easttown is one of the best television shows of the last 25 years.
Whoa.
I'm willing to lay it all down. I think it is masterful. It is so satisfying as a mystery. Talk about sticking the landing. The last episode of Mayor of Easttown is probably the episode that I would have selected for canon consideration because I think it so beautifully finishes everything, and it finishes everything in a way that's satisfying on the basics of mystery plotting, but also satisfying emotionally. And but looking back at episode 1, as I did for this conversation, I was thrilled to see that everything was there from the beginning. And of course, you knew that when you looked back on the series. But looking back on the first episode, there is so much happening that is important later, including the first 2 minutes of the show that seem like they are just there to set mood and tone. They're actually giving you an important piece of the overall murder puzzle. And I think this show succeeds also because it takes that basic plot pleasure and then wraps it in these really beautifully knotty, complicated emotional characters. The emotional lives of these characters are so fascinating, and they're so thorny, and they're so multifaceted. And all of that, I actually think, upon rewatching, is right there in episode 1. I mean, even the cousin who's the preacher gets to have like 7 different things about his personality that we learn in a single scene. And the way that they give the girl who dies in the first episode such a rich, interesting life, and her inner life is so palpable, and her relationships to all of the people in her life, including her son, are very beautifully drawn. And in fact, in rewatching, knowing what I know about the characters we meet later, like the mother of Andrew, the grandson, seeing those kinds of characters bouncing up against this woman, this young woman who dies, and how there's this like whole web of consistent heartache that runs through all of these people's lives, I just found it even more exhilarating the second time around. And I actually am going to rewatch the entire series because I've been forced to rewatch this first episode. And to me, that is a canon-worthy thing because I watched this show not that long ago and I really already want to watch it again.
Whoa.
Wow.
Sarah, why don't you go next?
I shall. I had never seen an episode before. I tend to avoid fictional crime series just because I am just tied up with nonfiction crime. And many people told me that I would enjoy this, and they were absolutely right. I was knocked the fuck out by this pilot. It's not piloty at all. I agree on the accent. My expertise is not as deep as our presenters or as some people's, but that don't and like clean water.
Water.
And she's not straining for it. Like, here's the thing about this particular accent. Like, when you're making a big deal about your place,
and it's Philly or the environs. They almost never bother to get a coach. And it's actually really not that difficult. There's like a handful of words that are going to tip you. And they got them all in this one. But without being too showy about it. And Julianne Nicholson, like, it's less strong for her, possibly because she, you know, is American, unlike Kate Winslet. But they do enough to indicate it. And like somebody cared enough to know that Philadelphians or people like who have people from around Philadelphia care about this and notice it. And they just like buttoned that all up. And I appreciated the effort. But what was really impressive to me was the scene setting and the extremely effective and evocative world building via the characters, but also visually. Like you had this like Winter's Bone of Pennsylvania feeling, and also that they didn't do that thing that prestige projects sometimes do where working class people's homes are appointed with this mid-century furniture that they could never afford versus what you actually see on Teen Mom, which is like a lot of factory second sectionals and not like not bothering to repaint because they're just going to move in a year and like stuff like that. Like this felt much more lived in. Do I necessarily buy in the world that is built that Kate Winslet and Guy Pearce are going to be fucking in his rental house? No, but I'm not mad about it because it's those two. And he has that total, like, took whatever JUCO writing teacher gig he could take and hasn't gotten it in like a year and a half look. Like, it's just, it's built with such care and love for these very real, struggling people who always look a little grimy, but also are sort of beautiful because of that. So the entire production, I think, is extremely impressive. I didn't really get any like piloty sort of like exposition, like these are the relationships. These are complicated relationships. They trust you to keep up or stick with it long enough to figure out who goes where. I really had to struggle. I just have a lot of work to do this week. I really just wanted to marinate in this show for the rest of the day. Mm-hmm. So I think that really, you know, that's one of my key criteria is whether I wanted to keep going. But, you know, I don't actually clean water. Like, oh my gosh, these people. And then they're just talking about cheesesteaks and she looks exhausted by even having to have that conversation, which that's also correct. Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's going to be extremely bleak and depressing. And I can't wait to sort of like walk into the cavern with these people. It's a really good show. And thank you, Carlos, not just for this presentation, which was spot on, but also for finally like bringing Buncee to this water, because I'm excited to engage with this in a way that, of course, the entire culture already did like a year ago. But what can I say? Sometimes I'm late to things. Tara.
Please promise me, Sarah, that you will call me after you finished. I can't wait to talk to you about it.
I'll dial every number but the last one and then just like swoon onto the keypad. It'll be great.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Tara.
All right. So I hadn't watched this either. And so, you know, Carlos, I'm sorry. We can't watch everything. But also, like, there's some shows that are just not for us. And I knew Sarah hadn't watched this. And I knew that the reason that she said was the reason. The reason I didn't watch it is because it really, I'm not here for a dead girl show. Like, I know this is more than that, but that's why I didn't watch it. Like, yeah. And, you know, if it's from a Europe, that's different. This feels like the American version of a Scandi show in many ways, but still, you know, not for me. But having said that, you know, the challenge of the canon is that you have to determine, like, even if this is something that's not for you, did it succeed in doing what it set out to do. And 100%, yes, it did. So even though I'm not going to continue watching it, I appreciated what this was doing. And the reason, largely what Sarah said in terms of the world building, this is a term that we usually think of like with regard to genre, where it's like we built this planet or the civilization out of like nothing, but like it's right. just as important here.
Mm. Like the Flintstones.
Yeah, exactly. It's just as important here to do that, because it's clear right from the very start, as Mark said, that like the place, I'm not going to say it's another character, but that it's crucial to telling this story in this way. And we see that in ways big and small, like, you know, with what Sarah was saying about the house, like the factory second couch, yes. But also when we see the grandson Drew's bedroom, like the amount of love that is lavished on mm-hmm. that space, like it's clear mm-hmm. all of the money that they have for decor, it's gone to this kid.
Yeah.
And to make that
and his
room,
bower of stars, like, look yeah. at your stars. I was like, yeah, this family would make sure he had stars before they mm-hmm. like even ate themselves. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But also just like in the casual moments too, like when the band is setting up in like the screen porch for the engagement party, there's just something about the way Roy from the office like just comes bustling out of the back door to get something out of the cooler that's sitting there. That's just like, it feels so natural. Like that's a party we've all been at 100 times, mm-hmm. like as a mm-hmm. teenager, as an adult, like just something about it, just the way he moved felt so real to me. And like every space we
big
were in,
Chris Huff energy, and I mean yeah. that in the best way.
Yeah, yeah, well, every space we were in felt like that. Like Mare going over to Lori's house and just like sitting down with the kid. You know, Lori's not there, her husband's not there. She just sits down and starts like having a chat, helps herself to pizza, because like this is what this place is like. And so mm-hmm. the how lived in it felt was just palpable in every scene. Like that's what I appreciated about it the most. Every mm-hmm. there didn't feel like a single choice that wasn't discussed, you know, like from
yeah.
what's Mare going to wear to the ceremony? Like, how is mm-hmm. she trying to fix herself up? Like her roots are grown out, like down to her eyebrows, but we know who this character is. And we have known since she was awakened in bed that morning. So, and when we see her looking at her fucking cracked phone screen, it's like, of course, Mare's phone screen
yes,
is cracked.
Of course she does.
Of course yep. it is. I was just enthralled by the masterfulness of how this was made. So whether it was for me or not, and it's not, I still could appreciate what they were doing. Dave.
All right. Well, as you can tell by how much I've talked so far, I'm a little under the weather today, but I just want to say the most upsetting thing about watching this episode is discovering that McCain's products are available in America. And it's not that I feel like they should be exclusive to Canada. You know, they make a lot of like frozen French fries and hash browns and stuff like that. And in Mare's house, you see a bag being prepared, you know, for something. And
pain relief.
Yeah, she's putting it on her ankle.
That's right. That's right. If there's actually McCain's made it to the States at some point in the past 25 years, why can't I get a McCain's frozen sheet cake? Cake.
Yes.
The best fucking cake ever. I don't care mm-hmm. if you like go into a bakery and you spend like $200 on some fancy cake that's got like Mario punching Darth Vader or whatever the fuck. You just get this cake and it's just like a flat example. Cake with a bunch of vanilla icing on it. And even mm-hmm. though it's frozen, it's always soft. I don't understand what goes into it. It's probably extremely carcinogenic. I don't care. I haven't had one in like 20 years. And once a week, I fucking crave it. And now I find out that McCain's, now I find out via Mayor of Easttown that McCain exists in the States, yet I can't go to my local HEB or Randall's, that seems to be the one that carries a lot of McCain's products, and get a frozen layer cake. Is the fucking travesty of learning about this show and all the things that this show is talking about. So even though I'm not going to vote, fuck this show. Let's put this official vote. Mark, what say you?
Hands down, yes.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Yes for me.
Tari Ariano.
Yes for me as well.
All right. So that means Mayor of Easttown, Season 1, Episode 1, Miss Lady Hawk herself. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's just that it's really tasty and it's available and it's always like nice and cold because it comes out of the freezer. It's like right there all the time. It's never not ready, no matter where it is in your world.
Yeah, people will say, well, the Pepperidge Farm cake, but no, Pepperidge Farm cakes freeze. What's amazing that the scientists at McCain have discovered is how you keep it in the freezer, but it does not freeze.
But also the icing doesn't, like the icing somehow is frozen yet doesn't freeze like icing. I don't know what's going on there. We'll develop an after show where we can talk about this further. Who is our winner of the week?
I do, and it's you. We are getting one step closer to your dream of a Ben Franklin miniseries because Michael Douglas and Benjamin Franklin together again for the very last time are going to series at Apple TV+. Actually, I wasn't sure about this, so I checked. Michael Douglas has played Ben Franklin before.
What?
In an educational series that, speaking of Quaid and Full, once again, Jeb and I had the misfortune of covering for this season called Freedom, A History of Us, where he played Ben Franklin and Dennis Quaid played, among other people, Robert E. Lee and Andrew Jackson and a New York Times reporter and someone who was kidnapped in Iran. So anyway,
well, Robert Michael E. Douglas Lee would have Ben never Franklin. Read the New York Times. I don't know what that's about.
Anyway, yay, Ben Franklin and Dave.
So, according to McCain's.ca, McCain.ca, glad the closest thing I could find is called Deep and Delicious. I don't know if it was called Deep and Delicious.
That's what it's called in Canada.
But the trays look way smaller now, so I'm hoping that hasn't changed. It's way smaller. But, because they have the vanilla one that I remember.
Yeah.
But it also has like chocolate shit on it now, which I don't remember. So I fear like they're messing with perfection here. But it feels like maybe some places in the States might carry it. So as we talk more about this, I will drift further into this madness. Who is our loser of the week?
Celebrities feeling like they need to weigh in on the Russia-Ukraine conflict. And I regret to say we have three bullet points here. 90210's Anna Lynn McCord, of course, 90210, the sequel series from the 2000s. She felt it necessary to record a poem addressed to Vladimir Putin.
If we learned nothing from Sobieski, come on.
I'm so sorry I was not your mother is how it starts. John Cena, who decided to try to promote Peacemaker by tying it into the current crisis. He wishes he were Peacemaker because then he would sort things out, etc. And former Drag Race contestant Carmen Carrera, who was like, prayers up for Ukraine, caption on shots on Instagram from her latest semi-nude photo shoot, really in poor taste. Just a reminder to celebrities and everyone, you can just not tweet. That's always an option that is available to you, and more people should take it. Speaking of options available to you, do you know what time it is?
Game time?
It's non-regulation game time.
Yay!
So apparently it's still only available in Canada, according to the internet. That's kind of bullshit, if you ask me.
We are between game time seasons, which means I am presenting a non-regulation game time, and this is called Ignorance of the Law and Order is No Excuse. Because our lead topic is so rich with trivia and lore, I wanted to use it as the basis for our non-regulation game time this week, but because there are two people playing who know the show very well, and one person who A, doesn't, and B, is dying, I constructed it in a way that should put you all on roughly equal footing. So there are two rounds. Round one is more or less. I'll give you two Law and Order stars. You have to tell me which was in more episodes.
You each get
three of these. And then round two is allocution. Dave will play a clip of a Law and Order guest star. You tell me who it is for 2 points. If you need a hint, I'll give you the title of a show where this actor was a series regular. Then it's worth 1 point. These aren't obscure Broadway actors. They're people whose names you know, I promise. And there are 21 of those for a total of 30 questions. And since it's a non-regulation game time, I will let you guess at each level in the second round. We also have a tiebreaker if we need it, or just for fun. There originally, by the way, was going to be a Spot the Fake round with episode titles, but the show's titles are so generic, it would not have been fun. Yeah. It's like, which is real, Hunted or...
Captive.
Exactly, right. Yes. So standard non-regulation game stakes apply. If Dave wins, he gets 3 steel meals to distribute as he wishes, plus the right to make me write a non-regulation game time in the future. I think at this point he has like 3 or 4 of these in his back pocket. If Mark or Sarah wins, they get 3 steel meals plus the right to make me watch something for a future around the dial. Do you have any questions?
No.
Are you ready to play Ignorance of the Law and Order is No Excuse?
Yes.
All right. Let us throw it to Picky to see who goes first.
We will start with Sarah.
All right. So our order is Sarah, Mark, Dave. Let us start with round one, More or Less. Sarah.
Yes.
Who was in more episodes? Jeremy Sisto, who played Detective Cyrus Lupo, or John Fiore, who played Detective Tony Profaci?
That is coming tough. In hot. I'm trying to remember when Profaci got thrown under the bus in order to get Logan off Staten Island. I think this is going to be actually pretty close. When did Sisto show up? Profaci. Fiore. Oh, buddy.
Jeremy Sisto's in 64 episodes versus Profaci's 53.
Oh, man.
Mark.
Yes.
Who was in more episodes? George Zunza played Detective... My autocorrect says Max Greeley. No, Max Greevy. Or Annie Parise, who played ADA Alexander Borgia.
Okay. She was on a season and a half to his season, so it's Annie Parise.
That's correct. 22 versus 34. David T. Cole. Mm-hmm. Who was in more episodes? Angie Harmon played ADA Abby Carmichael. You know her. She's Rizzoli and or Isles. I don't know which one.
Hello, Dan. Hello, Dan Casino. Dan Casino knows. Let us know, Dan.
Or Elizabeth Rome, who played ADA Serena Sutherland. And yes, I am asking because she is a lesbian.
I feel like based on nothing, and just before I answer, I will say this, quoting Brian McCourt, Vice President of Marketing at McCain Foods Canada, legend has it the original Deep and Delicious recipe was developed by accident by a food technologist at McCain, which totally tracks with how mysterious that whole fruit product is. It is the post-it note liquid paper of the Canadian food scene.
Uh-huh.
Angie Harmon.
Sorry. 72 versus Elizabeth Rome's 85.
You didn't let me finish.
Yeah.
Could have been the food technologist for all I know. But my answer is...
All right, back to Sarah. Benjamin Bratt, who played Detective Ray Curtis, versus Carolyn McCormick, who played Dr. Elizabeth Olivet.
Bratt.
Correct. 95 to 85.
Wow. Good one, Sarah. I would have gotten that wrong.
Mark.
Mm-hmm.
Alana De La Garza, who played ADA Connie Ruberosa in the episodes you apparently do not intend to rewatch, or Richard Brooks, who played ADA Paul Robinette.
Okay, this is, because he was in 3 seasons, but then he kept coming back. And then she was in, those last seasons all kind of blur together for me.
Yeah.
But I'm going to go with Alana De La Garza.
You're correct.
Ah.
Nice.
85 to 69.
Nice.
Thank you. Dave.
Yes.
Jerry Orbach played Detective Lenny Briscoe.
Yeah.
Or Stephen Hill, who played D.A. Adam Schiff, usually in a chair.
My mind is telling me that Adam Schiff was on the series longer, but I don't know if he was in every episode, like if they always went to him for news from the top.
Rumbly
Make
advice.
The deal. Yeah.
I got an election coming up. Just make sure you cross your T's and dot your I's. Whatnot. I'm going to go Adam Schiff. I'm great at this game.
No. Lenny Briscoe, 274 to 229. So it's close.
Ooh. All right.
All right. This is everyone's last question in this round, and then we'll do a score break. Sarah, Paul Sorvino as Sergeant Phil Serretta, or J.K. Simmons, and I am not just kidding, as Dr. Amos Goda.
Okay, well, Soretta, because Sorvino wanted to go work on his opera career, they shot him and shuffled him off to Buffalo after, like, I think. But then Skoda, although he was the new Olivet, he wasn't as Olivetti and omnipresent, I feel like. So I think this is actually really close. Skoda.
Correct. 31 to 45. Mark.
And I can tell you that one of those J.K. Simmons episodes is when he was just playing a random criminal, which I had forgotten about until my rewatch.
He often wore a turtleneck also and didn't hate it.
Mark, your last question in this round. Linus Roach, who played EADA Michael Cutter again in the episodes you didn't watch, versus Dan Florek, who played Captain Donald Cragen. And this is only Law & Order, not... Doesn't
right,
matter.
Not his SVU return.
That's correct.
Or his episodes that he directed.
Correct.
Oh, okay. Yes, Cutter showed up at the very end. But was it for three seasons? Because that's how long we got Florek. But the seasons at the beginning of the series were longer, too. So I'm going to say Florek.
You're right.
Yes.
Nice.
Holy shit, that was so close. 63 to 69.
Nice.
Nice.
Yeah. Dave, your last question.
Irish Linus Roach and his baseball. Okay.
Saved your best guy for last. Michael Moriarty, who played executive ADA Ben Stone, versus
Chicken Ball.
Fred Thompson, who played DA Arthur Branch.
Ooh.
He's just an old country lawyer.
That's right.
I'm going to say Ben Stone.
That's a shame.
But it's close. 88 to 160.
You have any questions about Deep and Delicious Cake?
If I'd not known anymore. This much of the episode would be about it, I would have. All right, let's get a score break before we go into the next round.
At the moment, David T. Cole is present, technically, or McCain Cake researcher, with 0 points. I have 2 points, and valued guest Mark Blankenship and his chair are leading with 3 points.
Wow, perfect round for Mark so far. Okay, round two, allocution. I'm going to play you a clip. You tell me who is in it. This is obvious, but if there are two voices in the clip, and I try to avoid ones where that's the case, I'm looking for you to identify the witness or suspect or whoever is speaking the most.
Gotcha.
But if you're not sure, you can ask and I'll tell you. And remember, you can guess before and after a hint.
Mm.
Sarah D. Bunting, clip 10 is for you.
There's not one shred of direct evidence connecting David to the murder.
Except photos, phone calls, and falsehoods.
All right, so your theory is that David hired Mike Adams to keep Boone from publishing a phantom book that would somehow imperil David's father. A man serving a life sentence. A man who's dying of cancer, please.
The lady.
Yeah, I'm looking for the lady. Can I hear part of it again, please? I don't think it'll help, but...
There's not one...
Can I hear another part of it?
There's not one shred of direct evidence connecting David to the murder.
Except photos, phone calls, and falsehoods.
All right, so your theory is that David hired Mike Adams to keep Boone from publishing a phantom book that would somehow imperil David's father. A man serving a life sentence. A man who's dying of cancer, please.
I can't pull it, and I know it's not Benson, so could I have a hint, please?
Sure. This person was a series regular on a little show called Rectify.
Is that J. Smith Cameron?
Yes, it is for 1 point.
Ooh.
Mark, clip 11 is for you.
Yeah, I called the limo service that day. Told him Christoph was ready to roll. But I didn't cancel it.
Any idea who did?
You mean who set him up to get shot? No, sorry.
Okay, I'm just going to go with my gut. Is it Billy Porter?
Yes, it is.
Oh, wow, yeah. Nice.
Good job, 2 points. All right, clip 12 is for David T. Cole.
I knew a man from Attica. He told me he's planning something big to wake this country up. He told me I could help do some odd jobs, like I was his errand boy.
Did he tell you what he was planning?
A bomb.
All right, I'm just going to say, because Dave is disadvantaged.
Yeah, let me answer first,
okay.
And then we'll see. Well, I get a free guess, right?
Yeah, you do.
Is that... Oh, shit, what's his real name? Is that Michael K. Williams?
Yes, it is.
Nice.
What I was about to say, and I'll apply this to all of you. You can say it's whoever played X and Y, and I'll give it to you because, as we said, Dave is dying.
All right.
Sarah, clip 13 is for you.
Sure, Abby and I have problems. I'm sure all couples do from time to time. Let me tell you something. I truly believe, that each person on this planet has only one true soulmate. Abby and I were born for each other. No, I didn't hit her. And I certainly didn't kill her.
Carrie! Is that Mandy Patinkin?
It is Mandy Patinkin for 2 points. Clip 14 is for Mark.
I understand your concern, Mr. McCoy, but the potential prejudice is far outweighed by Mr. Worley's right to call witnesses in support of his case.
Oh, shoot. Okay, can you play that one more time?
Shoot.
I understand your concern, Mr. McCoy, but the potential prejudice is far outweighed by Mr. Worley's right to call witnesses in support of his case.
Okay, if I guess and I'm wrong, can I then get a hint?
Yes.
Okay, is it Elizabeth Ashley?
No.
Okay.
Your hint is Murphy Brown.
Is that Candace Bergen?
Yes.
Whoa.
For 1 point, that is Candace Bergen.
She has a certain Elizabeth Ashley.
She does have a certain Elizabeth Ashley. Did you ever read her memoir? It's amazing.
I've heard it's good, yeah. Okay, clip 15 is for Dave.
The deed speaks for itself. Davy Buckley was out of his mind. He wasn't thinking about the consequences of his actions. He couldn't. He was focused solely on the insane act of taking his own life. Davy Buckley has a troubled history of behaviors that point to an undiagnosed mental illness. Depression. Bipolar disorder. He never had the resources to get the help he needed. He fell through the cracks. Davy Buckley was an accident waiting to happen.
I know that voice, but I could be here for 12 years and I would never match it to a face because that's the way my brain doesn't work. So I'll take the hint.
Okay. Well, he wasn't quite a series regular, but he was very present in one season of Breaking Bad.
It's Moff Gideon from Mandalorian. It's,
that's right. I'll give it to you because I said I would. It's Giancarlo Esposito.
Yeah, thank you.
Right. For 1 point. Sarah D. Bunting, clip 60.
When our country went to war, not all our soldiers were equipped with life-saving body armor. Military supply has been playing catch-up since we invaded Iraq, so we tripled production to output 3,000 units a month.
Why push production so hard?
Because soldiers' lives are on the line. The longer we take, the longer they have to wait.
Oh, Picky, you scamp. Titus Welliver?
It is, in fact, Titus
Took
Welliver.
Me a minute, too. It was like, okay.
I would just like to note that we could play an entire game time game just on Law & Order episodes that ask if we should blame the gun manufacturers for what happens with the guns.
Yeah, we could.
Well, you accepted a suicidal Imperial officer from The Mandalorian? For that
yes.
last one?
Yes.
Thank you.
Clip 17.
Cyber capsules. Yes.
Clip 17 is for Mark.
My sister, she was 13 years old, leukemia. And the medicine they gave her just made her blow up like a beach ball. And she was so beautiful. And she was in so much pain. And to my 12-year-old eyes, I thought this treatment is worse than the disease.
And now he's with the children, Mr. McCoy. He's helping the children. And then later, when he agrees to a lighter sentence, what can I say? Sometimes I feel mercy. That's Ann Dowd, who I actually got to interview about this episode once.
Oh, wow.
This is not that episode. It's a different one. All of these are from the later seasons because those are the only ones that are on Peacock. But yes, I love
well, still, too. I just wanted it to be that one. But yes, Ann Dowd, great. Law & Order all-time guest star.
Indeed. Dave, clip 18 is for you.
Two things I know about Pope. Nick worked for him, and Nick's head came home in a box.
So, yeah, I'd love to hear what Pope has to say about that.
Where were you Tuesday night?
Shift ends at 8, then I went home.
Alone?
Yeah.
No idea.
Your hint is Parks and Recreation.
That, Adam Scott?
Yes, it is. For 1 point. Sarah D. Bunting, clip 19.
The Spread Eagle.
Trina asked me to come over to discuss an intervention for my son, Chaz. For Chaz's sake, I went. A decision that I regret with all my heart. Right away, Trina started attacking me on my parenting. I tried to keep the focus on Chaz, but that just infuriated her.
All right, here's the problem. I think I got it. But that actually really sounds like Jeremy Sisto, which is an issue. I think, however, it is Mr. Lisa Rinna. Mary Hamlin.
That's correct. And I think Jeremy Sisto plays his lawyer in this episode.
Oh, God. Exactly.
All right, clip 20 is for Mark.
Mr. McCoy, there's a family here drowning in tragedies. What's the right thing to do?
Well, there's the law with a capital L. And there's people, too. Well, I'm not supposed to think about them. But I am thinking about them.
Is this Jeffrey Tambor
as
a judge?
Yes, it is.
This is the Jump the Shark episode of Law & Order, I think. I have often thought that his performance in this episode made the show become a different thing.
Hmm. All right. Clip 21 is for Dave, and then we'll get a quick scoreboard.
You know, I've watched your back plenty. That Monday after Thanksgiving? Oh, your experiments? After you set them up, you disappeared for the rest of the night. I had to enter the data for you. And the next Monday, you pulled this same crap. I covered your back. I always cover everyone's back.
Zero idea. I'm really good at this one. Hint, please.
Well, he was in Girls, but you know him better from
Adam Driver.
That is Adam Driver for one.
From the Mandalorian adjacent movie,
yes.
The Force Awakens.
All right, where are the scores, please, Sarah?
David T. Cole has 5. I have 9. Mark Blankenship has 10. Dun, dun, dun. Or chung, chung, chung.
All right, you each have 3 questions left. Sarah D. Bunting, clip 22 is for you.
I acted in haste yesterday without considering the precedents. I'm reversing my ruling on the motion to exclude the children's fingerprints.
Your Honor.
It's the law. It was simply a misunderstanding. Is there anything else, Ms. Adams?
No.
Very well, then, if you'll excuse me.
Could I hear that again, please?
I acted in haste yesterday without considering the precedents. I'm reversing my ruling on the motion to exclude the children's fingerprints.
Your Honor.
It's the law. It was simply a misunderstanding. Is there anything else, Ms. Adams?
No.
Very well, then, if you'll excuse me.
Is that Ned Beatty?
It is Ned Beatty for 2 points.
Well done.
Otis.
That episode, like, I can't watch it again. It's good, but it's just so sad.
Mm-hmm. Clip 23 is for Mark.
You're charging my wife with a murder she didn't commit. Santana killed Decker. Not by himself. He told me that he'd had him taken care of. He asked me if there were any loose ends. He didn't want any bad news about the fund until he got his money out. The man terrified me. I told him about Dawn Prescott and the story she was working on. And he told me she'd be dealt with.
Oh, my God. It's right on the tip of my tongue, but I need the hint.
This gentleman was in Gilmore Girls.
A show I've never seen. Can I have another?
No.
Oh, wait, no. Is it Edward Herman?
Yes, it is.
Wow.
Who's also in another much better episode than this, where he uses the justification.
Voiced FDR in the Ken Burns miniseries.
Right. All right, clip 24 is for Dave.
The only thing I can't stand about Law & Order is all the damn vampires.
Mr. Carroll. I'm Detective Cassidy. Why don't you take a seat?
Take the cuffs off and let me out of this godforsaken rat's nest, damn it. You don't have the warrants to hold me.
You blew a .13. You've been placed under arrest for DWI.
Screw you, sugar tits. I have powerful friends who will crucify you and your people for even putting your hands on me. Can you hear that behind the mirror?
I know the voice, but once again, that's not the way my brain works, so I'll take the hint.
All right. This gentleman, in quotes, was on Community.
Oh.
Well, you could throw him in a volcano without much, that much harm.
I'm just going to listen to a little bit of that again because my brain just farted.
Mr. Carroll, I'm Detective Cassidy.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay. That's, Chevy Chase.
Yes, it is Chevy Chase.
When you said volcano, I was like, it's not Dan Hedaya, Sarah. We're not talking about that.
Clip 25 is for Sarah.
What happened was that some bad cops tried to frame me for my wife's murder. Now Serena gets killed and I'm your first stop. It's like deja vu all over again. Look, Serena and I were both being harassed, and not just by the tabloids. Don raised holy hell. He got my book buried. He wanted Serena's head on a platter right next to mine.
I need to hear it again. Sorry.
What happened was that some bad cops tried to frame me for my wife's murder. Now Serena gets killed and I'm your first stop. It's like deja vu all over again. Look, Serena and I were both being harassed, and not just by the tabloids. Don raised holy hell. He got my book buried. He wanted Serena's head on a platter right next to mine.
Oh my God, I'm going to be so mad. I don't know why I can't pull it. It's not an Arkin. I need a hint.
He was a series regular for one season of Boardwalk Empire.
Oh, Bloody Naked Bobby Cannavale.
It is Bloody Naked Bobby Cannavale. All right, clip 26 is for Mark.
You young people can't possibly imagine how charismatic he was, John Fitzgerald Kennedy. He inspired me to all sorts of public service.
Such as what, Mrs. McIntyre? The Peace Corps?
And what would be the fun in that?
I have spent so much of my life watching this television show. that is Rue McClanahan.
It is Rue McClanahan. Dave, clip 27 is for you.
Special Agent Jamal Atkinson. This Colt 38 Special was recovered from the home of Peter Rubin by federal agents. Here's my chain of custody affidavit. If your case goes to trial, keep me off the stand.
Is that Lance Reddick?
It is Lance Reddick,
yeah.
For 2 points.
Well done.
All right, you each have one question left, so let's get the score.
Okay, Dave making a late run with 8. I have 12. Mark Blankenship has 13.
Oh, damn. It all comes down to this. Clip 28 is for Sarah.
I remember that case well. That poor girl was hurt pretty bad. Right, William Timmons. I understand he was shot a couple days ago in your neck of the woods. Well, bullet never found a more deserving home. When we learned of his passing, we had his place in town secured in case you wanted to take a look at it.
Oh, fuck. Can I hear it again, please?
I remember that case well. That poor girl was hurt pretty bad. Right, William Timmons. I understand he was shot a couple days ago in your neck of the woods. Well, bullet never found a more deserving home. When we learned of his passing, we had his place in town secured in case you wanted to take a look at it.
That's a shame. Hint.
SpongeBob SquarePants.
Also from The Mandalorian, Sarah.
Oh, yeah.
not going to help you.
No, that's really not going to help me. Yeah. I was like, David Hasselhoff?
He's been in a lot of places, but there could be only one.
Well, you know what? Congratulations, Mark. I'm just going to guess David Hasselhoff because I don't know.
Who is it, Dave?
It's Mr. Clancy.
Clancy Brown.
Oh, the Clance. Of course.
All right, Mark, your final question is 29.
No offense.
None taken, honey. The customer's always right. You know, I got a friend now. Just be sure to give him an extra big tip for me, okay?
Okay, please play that again.
No offense.
None taken, honey. The customer's always right. You know, I got a friend now. Just be sure to give him an extra big tip for me, okay?
Oh my God, I can. I need the
hint. If he doesn't get it, can I steal it for like the win for everything? Just because that's the way it works now?
Well, we haven't done steal meals, so no, but you can look very superior when
you
answer.
I don't know if I know it, but I have a guess.
Okay. I think you
Anyways,
may.
He wants the hint.
The hint is Orange is the New Black.
Laverne Cox, of course.
It is Laverne Cox, and I want to say, if she chooses to, they should have her back on the new show as a lawyer while they still can, because she played a sex worker on the show more than once, and it's not okay.
Yeah.
Finally, clip 30 is for David T. Cole.
All right.
So we went upstairs together. So what? Girl knew what she wanted. No crime in that. Nah, man, she just couldn't keep her hands off me. Who said she was drunk? Sugar? That bitch is jealous is all.
Of what, you having another woman in her room or something else?
Girl needs to be put in her place sometime. Needs reminding that Tito ain't a one-woman man. I didn't think she'd eliminate the competition, though.
No, no idea.
Well, Dave, would it surprise you to learn this person is in The Mandalorian as a series regular?
Yes, it would.
Yes.
So we went upstairs together. So what? Girl knew what she wanted. No crime in that. Nah, man. She just couldn't keep her hands off me. Who said she was drunk? Sugar?
Oh, that bitch it's Baby Yoda. I don't know who it is.
You don't know?
I don't know.
It's Pedro Pascal.
Really?
Yes.
Does not sound like him at all to me.
It is.
No, it really doesn't.
No.
All right, let's get.
I was prepared to give you a point for Baby Yoda just for style.
All right, what are our final scores?
Dave finishes stronger with 8 points.
I don't need your pity commentary.
Yes, you do. And Mark is our winner with 14 points.
All right, congratulations.
Value guess.
Do we want to play the tiebreaker?
Sure.
Shout it out when you know it.
My wife was concerned about our children's well-being. Of course. We both were. So we got assurances from the producers that we could review the tapes. That
was
we could
Billy
protect
Eichner?
Them.
What did you
I
say?
Was Billy satisfied. Eichner? And so was she.
Then why did she tell Miss Alvarez otherwise?
I don't believe she did.
We've heard testimony that on the day of the murder, when you returned home with your children, you altered your usual routine.
My wife had been tired that morning. I thought she might be napping, so I held the kids back. It wasn't that unusual.
So
Jim Gaffigan?
You didn't kill your wife, Mr. Johnson?
Yes.
Of course not.
All right, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
Jim Gaffigan,
Ira D. Bunting,
do give me a water ice,
and Mark Blankenship.
It's a Law and Order reference.
Thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot.
There's one cake so good, it will keep you coming back for more. McCain deepened delicious cakes, sealed with a see-through dome to keep in all that rich, moist, deliciously fresh taste.
Oh.
So, you can raid the cake tray, seal up the rest, and put it back in the freezer. Till you're ready for the very next craving. McCain deepened delicious, cakes so good, it'll keep you coming back for more.